of hubris, arrogance, imperialism, and real genuine fear, I think, of the extent to which the Caribbean could be involved, fueled American ambition to try and stamp out any nascent light of an alternative socialist agenda in the region.
Very strongly put, and I'll just have to pause you there for now.
Hello, my name is Damani Baker. I am the director of The House on Cocoa Road, a documentary about my mother. My mom moved my sister and I from Oakland, California, where I was born and raised, to take part in the Grenada Revolution. So this film was about how we ended up in Grenada in the first place, how we ended up in a country that eventually would be invaded by the United States as my family hid under a bed when bombs dropped all around us. In order to understand that, I had to go back and retrace my mother's history, her story. Her story of having parents who were part of the Great Migration West, great-grandparents who were sharecroppers in the South, how she served children in the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program, and eventually became Angela Davis' teaching assistant at UCLA in the 60s. So this is a film about women leaders, it's about my mother, and it's about people who really imagined a better way to live.
So that was Damani Baker there himself speaking about the purpose of this film. And I think what's special about this documentary, and also quite unique, is that it offers, as well as being a political film, it offers an intimate look at Damani's personal life. What do you make of this sort of aspect of the film? Was it important?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it sort of falls into that kind of who do you think you are, that kind of the TV series where people look back into their roots. So it starts out as Damani Baker looking back and trying to figure out how on earth his family got here from there. So, you know, his great-grandmother was part of a sharecropping family in the American South, and there was Great Migration, then civil rights, you know, the advances in civil rights. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to piece out where he falls and how come that he, as a young filmmaker, you know, has the time, the leisure time, and the money to go around the world making movies, and you know,
even the title of the film, The House on Cocoa Road, has a personal touch, doesn't it?
Yes, it's trying to sort of pin down places in the past and to sort of plot a, if you like, a sort of straight line. You know, how do we get here now in this moment, given everything that's gone before us, and given the indifference of white America to our family and our struggles? You know, how did we get through all that to get to where we are today? And you know, the archive footage is very important in sort of nailing down exactly where that family was at those particular times.
I suppose this is a very symbolic message then, Lee, that politics is kind of inseparable to Black African Americans and their life and their struggle to the present day.
Absolutely, deeply intertwined, and we very much live our lives vicariously through those politics. But I think it's also an interesting narrative on the phenomenon of migration in the modern world, and how those migratory tales can be best be told by the sort of intimate portrait of an individual or group of individuals who are seeking to make a better life for themselves and often escape, you know, horrendous and circumstances. So I think it speaks to that broader narrative. And within that, there's the African diaspora, which scattered across the four ends of the earth, is in a perpetual search for its own identity, its own place in the world, and very much the stepping stones from Africa to the West are seen as important steps along that story.
And that reminds me, actually, of what you were saying of the main protagonist in this documentary, Damani Baker's mother.
Yeah.
What did you make of her contribution, Mike?
It's very important that, actually, the bulk of the voices that you hear in this documentary are female. So it's Fanny, it's her friends and her neighbours in Grenada. It's about women trying to make a life for themselves and trying to raise a family. And it's also... The film itself is the work of a son trying to pay tribute to a mother who raised him right. And I think that's why it's so emotional and so affecting at the end of the day.
I'm here in Free Grenada for the very first time. The experiences that I've had here in Grenada have confirmed in a very powerful way where we are headed, what the future of the entire planet ought to look like. This beautiful, powerful, militant revolution.
My sister Fania and I were so excited by what we saw. We were so struck by the enthusiasm of the not only the leaders, but the everyday people. For us, Grenada, especially for black people, really marked a new moment in history.
It just sort of captured the imagination of us. Here's a socialist government, a revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
There was legendary activist Angela Davis, world-renowned scholar and activist, and was a member of the Black Panther Party. Now, Lee, in the film, Grenada was described by black people as being a sort of utopia for black people. And Maurice Bishop, the Prime Minister at the time, and he was tragically later shot dead, said, if we have 95% of predominantly African origin in our country, then we can have a dangerous appeal to 30 million black people in the United States. So why was there such a longing from African Americans for sort of this a strong black community and leadership?
I think very much African Americans had, coming out of the Vietnam War, were beginning to reassess their place in society. They'd taken part in the Olympics, they'd fought in world wars, and yet they were still facing them as horrendous police brutality and economic discrimination in the land of the home of the free and the land of the brave. Mm-hmm. And I think they began to fundamentally reassess, or at least some did, reassess the extent to which they could prosper in such societies. And as all African diasporas do, they look to elsewhere in the world where their fortunes might be greater. And of course, there's a deep longing and a sort of Garveyan sense of the Jamaican leader Marcus Garvey to build black nation, to build an example of how humanity can work together in a progressive way. And very much the ideals of Cuba and the Grenada revolutionary movement encapsulated for very many black diasporans, African diasporans, their desire to see black nationhood, to see progressive socialism encapsulated and led by, you know, not just Cuba, but joined in by other islands in and around the Caribbean. And as such, it elevated itself into a international country of appeal, where the revolutionary movement put out a worldwide appeal for Africans in the diaspora to come help rebuild Grenada and be part of that movement. And lots of people from the United Kingdom, from the United States, other parts of the world, responded to that call.
That was very revealing indeed. I don't think many people know about this aspect of Grenada from the black perspective.
Yeah.
And just speaking of that, Mike, I think also what's invaluable of Baker's documentaries, this archive material he has that juxtaposes sort of the propaganda, and he touches on the role of the media. Mm-hmm. What is life like? How was life painted for black people in Grenada, and the reality of it?
Well, I mean, this is one of the important facets of this particular film. You get a sense of a place that is trying to, I think the phrase that Maurice Bishop uses, to throw off the Coca-Cola mentality and go in a different direction. And so you do get the footage that we get here that was taken by Damani Baker's own family is very much from the ground up. You're seeing, you know, a kind of grassroots movement building. You know, you're seeing people, you know, taking control of their own destinies in a way that clearly threatened the Reagan administration. And you get this sort of strange sort of contrast between Angela Davis and that particular way of thinking and the Ronald Reagan way of thinking, which, you know, is a little, shall we say, slightly more fearful.
Yes. Resonates a lot with today, of course.
I think so. And, you know, those contrasts, yes, do have a resonance in what's going on in America today with the way certain white leaders are espousing their values.
You're not naming any names,
Not naming any names, no.
Well, we'll have to move swiftly on just for now.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
All of a sudden, the drugs came in so heavy. It was scary, but it destroyed the entire city of Oakland. I mean, there's a discussion now where that came from. Entire black communities were destroyed. With all of my efforts to put you in a good school and try to balance it, there was still, we could sit on that hill in East Oakland and hear gunfire all down the hill all night.
It was very disappointing to see all the work that we've done being overrun by drugs. It was not a happy time in the black community anywhere in the States.
That was not an environment to raise children. A little bit more of Angela Davis there. And we talked a little bit about her, but I'd like to talk about her a little bit more just before we end the show. And Mike, what do you make of her contribution to this documentary?
It's very important. I mean, she turns up very early on in the film because Fanny Damani Baker's mother was a student of hers at the
UCLA,
yes, and later became her assistant. So it's almost about the role of mentoring in American life and how having a good mentor can, you know, change the way you think about the world, change the way you perceive the world. And I think Angela Davis becomes almost Fanny's mentor, you know, and takes her to protests and leads her into a more engaged way of thinking about the world.
And the documentary sheds light on her fair share of struggle, Angela Davis, in her life for racial equality. What does she mean for black activists everywhere?
Hugely symbolic figure for black activists worldwide. Continues to be an inspiration today for the millennials who you see in the Black Lives Matter movement and wider. African women on the continent still revere Angela Davis. She's held in extraordinarily high regard right across the world. And quite rightly so, when you think about the radical stance that she took, putting herself in danger, risking jail, risking a loss of her life, all for the principled struggle for justice and equality. Angela Davis, you know, remains a very sort of bright, burning firmament on the skyline, and she will be revered, I think, for a long time to come.
And what I found inspiring, actually, from this documentary was watching her leadership and how the black unions at the time in the 80s organized. Do you think movements today can learn a lot about that era?
Well, we look at the post-Weinstein movement and the Me Too movement, and we realize just how far we've got to come. People have to realize when Angela Davis was doing what she was doing, we were talking about 1970s, late 60s America, where the kind of super black machismo was still very much of the sort of shaft. You know, militant young black man was still the focus of the struggle, and along comes Angela Davis, and in one stroke recenters that struggle, putting black women at the heart of that movement. It was revolutionary at the time, and when you look back on it, you have to appreciate just how significant it really was.
And Mike, we're running towards the end of the show now. I just wanted to get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I found it, you know, inspirational. I found it very engaging. I also found it very educational. I mean, I've not seen much treatment, cinematic treatment, of the events in Grenada. So to have a, you know, a first-hand perspective, to have people who are actually on the ground at the time telling the story in their own words, in this very laid-back, you know, very informal way, it was an education for me.
And Lee, if I could turn to you, your final thoughts, and would you recommend this film?
Definitely recommend the film. I think that anything that captures that sort of historical narrative from the victim perspective is going to offer really unique insights for people, and also for people to get a real appreciation of how important globally the Grenadian Revolution was to Africans right across the world.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the book, The Room Where It Happened, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton reiterates President Donald Trump's quote three times, that for United States, the EU is worse than China, only smaller. The building of the modern global trade system was a project led by the United States and Europe over several decades following the Second World War. Donald Trump's America First trade policy has been especially self-destructive. He sees every trade issue as a zero-sum battle that the United States must win at all costs, precluding any cooperation that serves both sides' interests. But it should be just as clear that a victory by Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden in November would not heal all wounds in the U.S.-European Union relationship. The fact is that in the countries on both sides of the Atlantic, proponents of free trade as the solution to all political impasses do not consider that communism and socialism are not the most important rivals and enemies of the free market. Rather, it is the free economies of other hegemons and countries. We now present you an article written by Farshid Faranakian, an Iranian attorney at law who holds a PhD in oil and gas law. The piece is titled, For US, EU is worse than China, only smaller in transatlantic trade disputes. Please stay with us for more of Farshid Faranakian's article. Iran is mentioned 755 times in the book The Room Where It Happened, which contains 18-month recollections of John Bolton as U.S. President Donald Trump's National Security Advisor. In fact, among other countries, the name of Iran is mentioned the most in this book. Also, the name or title of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and President of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, and Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has been mentioned 28, 26, and 43 times respectively. This volume of attention to Iran and its high-ranking officials indicates that the White House can never ignore Iran's position as its vital role in regional and international developments, and is forced to pay attention to this issue. Of course, the 167 repetitions of the name Europe in John Bolton's book, many of which have been used to express the European Union's serious disagreement with Donald Trump on various issues, highlight the importance of the outcome of the recent United States presidential election for its members. Donald Trump does not look at the EU as an ally or even a partner, but as a rival. The difference that is taken into consideration in the following of this article is a difference in perception of the concept of free trade between this union and Donald Trump. This difference of opinion is such that it has brought the countries on both sides of the Atlantic to a serious trade war. By the mid-1990s, the United States found itself in a position of primacy, unmatched in modern history. Its combination of economic, military, and soft power dwarfed all others, and scholars such as William Wilberforce and Stephen Brooks offered arguments for why the unipolar era might last as long or even longer than the bipolar era that preceded it. What these optimists did not anticipate was a series of self-inflicted wounds that the United States would suffer in the years that followed, a train wreck of recurring blunders that has accelerated and worsened under President Donald Trump. Before Trump, the mistakes of the unipolar era fell under three main headings. The first era was adopting a grand strategy of liberal hegemony, which sought to supposedly spread democracy, markets, and other so-called liberal values far and wide, and to bring the whole world into a liberal order that was designed and led by the United States. The second mistake was to allow public institutions to deteriorate by starving them of resources and then blaming them for all problems. The third misstep was the weaponization of partisan politics. Unfortunately, these three trends were also sharply at odds with each other. As Farid Zakaria, an Indian-American journalist, noted back in 1998, the result was a hollow hegemony, as the United States tried in vain to manage the world on the cheap. The consequences of these three errors provided the toxic brew that allowed an incompetent and narcissistic charlatan like Donald Trump to reach the White House. His only significant foreign policy achievement to date is getting Britain to decide not to use Huawei technology for its new fifth generation digital network, but that's not much to show for nearly 4 years in office. When the United States and the European Union fight over trade, it might lack the intensity and geopolitical impact of the US-China trade war. But what transatlantic trade disputes have so far lacked in terms of drama, they make up for with a history of irreconcilable differences and sheer tenacity, which does not bode well for the relationship going forward, no matter who wins the US presidential election. Take the dispute of more than 15 years over the various government subsidies enjoyed by rival aircraft makers Airbus and Boeing. Part of the aircraft dispute hinges on a fundamental question that is playing out with the rise of China. To what extent should countries be permitted to bend the rules in order for their companies to catch up with dominant market leaders? There is no legal answer to this question. It requires a negotiated settlement, however difficult those negotiations might be. In other words, 16 years of fighting have achieved nothing but new tariffs that hurt exporters of unrelated products, and that have not helped either company. That self-destructive failure has set a template for U.S.-European Union trade relations. Instead of finding mutually acceptable resolutions to trade problems, each side has dug in deeper, often inflaming public opinion. U.S.-European disagreements have entrenched the idea that product regulations are purely a national matter, even if they are often internationally used to block trade. The ongoing Airbus-Boeing dispute was one of several that derailed the grandly named Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, TTIP, which was supposed to be a comprehensive deal to align the two superpowers of trade at a time when the growing challenge from China was becoming apparent. But in 2016, after 3 years and 15 rounds of negotiations, the planned agreement died without a single chapter being concluded. President Donald Trump reiterated his threat to impose a hefty tariff on European cars, mainly aimed at German companies such as Volkswagen and Daimler-Benz. Donald Trump claimed that the EU was formed in order to take advantage of the United States, and he has frequently said that Europe treats us worse than China. The United States has also launched an investigation under Section 301, the same law used to impose tariffs on China, into new digital taxes levied or under consideration in the European Union and several of its member states. The European Union, in turn, has promised to retaliate in kind against any new US tariffs. European Union Trade Commissioner Phil Hogan warned that he expected an especially turbulent relationship with the United States in the months leading up to the November presidential election. The United States and Europe are threatening tariffs against each other instead of finding common ground. Corporate taxation is another battleground. With governments across the world starved for resources to fight the COVID-19 pandemic, they need to find better ways to tax global companies, such as Apple, that are increasingly effective at avoiding taxes. In the book, The Room Where It Happened, John Bolton reiterates Trump's quote three times, that for the United States, the European Union is worse than China, only smaller. The building of the modern global trade system was a project led by the United States and Europe over several decades following the Second World War. Donald Trump's America First trade policy has been especially self-destructive. He sees every trade issue as a zero-sum battle that the United States must win at all costs, precluding any cooperation that serves both sides' interests. But it should be just as clear that a victory by Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden in November would not heal all the wounds in U.S.-European Union relationship. The fact is that in the countries on both sides of the Atlantic, proponents of free trade as the solution to all political impasses do not consider that communism and socialism are not the most important rivals and enemies of the free market. Rather, it is the free economies of other hegemons and countries. Throughout history, Western European powers have repeatedly pushed other free economies to the brink of war or economic blockade in order for their free economy to flourish. France, the United Kingdom, the Netherlands, Portugal, and Spain have competed for maximum freedom of action for themselves and minimum economic freedom for others. Those who think that the free market leads to freedom and prosperity of all countries ignore the violent aspect of competition, namely natural confrontation and conflict. They want to follow the romantic theory of abundance, which believes that there is room for everyone on earth and that there are unlimited resources in the market, and that one can always reach a win-win situation by thinking. Unfortunately, history and the natural sciences do not confirm any of these optimistic post-Second World War assumptions. Trade tensions between China, Europe, and United States are the latest example of the truth that has existed on the planet for thousands of years. Market resources and capacity are limited. The free market is good, but for me, not for my enemy. A free market leads to the freedom and prosperity of some nations and the captivity and poverty of other nations. The free market is good if you're strong, and if you're weak, the free market is bad. Same as the forest is good for the lion and bad for the sheep. You may ask, isn't the free market itself going to be strengthening us? The answer is maybe. If sheep survive in the forest, maybe. Strengthening is possible only through knowing and learning, not through blindly implementing an economic model. That is why a unipolar world order is neither natural nor stable, nor fundamentally possible. The free market is not a saving religion to unite the nations under its flag. The goal of all nations in history has been and will be their economic freedom and the captivity of others. There is no easy way out.
Debate.
The U.S. presidential election has finally happened, but not without controversy. The polls, first of all, were way off. The race is a tight one between Biden and Trump, so close that Trump has said that he would forge ahead, discounting the vote count, take it to the Supreme Court if necessary, of course, unless the vote is in his favor. Isn't that considered contesting the vote? Just one of the issues we will discuss in this edition of The Debate.
As expected, Election Day in the United States ended with no clear winner in the presidential election. Early returns seemed to give Donald Trump the key Electoral College swing states of Florida and Ohio, as the widely touted blue wave for Democratic challenger Joe Biden never materialized. However, a record number of mail-in votes means that counting could drag on for days, especially if vote totals remain close. The vote could even drag on for weeks, with hundreds of election-related lawsuits filed even before the polls opened. A highly controversial president and a highly controversial election now seem set for a highly controversial tabulation process.
Just kind of tired of it all. We've been in this election for 2 years, basically. And I've heard from a lot of friends that just, they're just kind of scared and worried about, chaos, worried about what the process is going to look like. Seems like a lot of things leading up to this has caused a lot of people to worry and be distrustful of, if the votes are going to be all counted and everything, so.
Polls showed that 3 out of 4 Americans were worried about violence on Election Day, probably because the mainstream media had talked about it constantly for months. But many major cities took extreme security measures, and the massive pitched battles between right-wing militias, anarchist groups, and cops never really occurred. However, nationwide rallies are set for the day after the election, and the lack of a clear victor could mean that America continues to see unprecedented protests and social unrest in 2020.
I think there's going to be violence. Doesn't matter who wins. So, like, if Trump wins, we got all the Black Lives Matter, LGBT community who are going to, like, come out here and protest. But if, Trump doesn't win, we got all the, like, white supremacists or the Trump supporters coming out.
The U.S. appears headed for a drawn-out election dispute like in the year 2000, which will be decided by lawyers and judges and not voters. As is the case with most of this exceptional year of 2020, the only certainty appears to be uncertainty. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Noel Fritsch, who's a conservative consultant and commentator, joining us from Washington, D.C. We also have Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco. I'd like to welcome you both. Noel Fritsch, let me first start with you. This is what Trump has said. He said this is a fraud that's placed against the American people. The American people deserve better than this. I am the victor of this election. Your reaction to his statement there?
Well, since he was inaugurated January of 2017, they have been attempting to execute an ongoing coup every day, and now almost for 4 years. They began with their phony narrative that he was going to lose some special election contests in a series of elections across the country, Montana and Georgia notably, where the Democrats and the wealthy global bankster elites poured tens of millions of dollars into little U.S. House races. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 million dollars for one for John Ossoff in Georgia 6 in the northern suburbs of Atlanta, of course, where there's going to be a contest now. And those were all swatted down handily. Trump and the Trump voters every single time just beat back those phony contests where the media tried to pump up that narrative. And now you have, you know, you went through 2 years of the Russia collusion hoax, the same fake news media that gave you the phony Kavanaugh rape allegations, the same news media that gave you, before Kavanaugh, the phony, totally disappeared Judge Roy Moore allegations in Alabama in that special election, which of course got memory hold, the same fake news media that gave you the Ukraine hoax, which of course was projection, because now we know with the Hunter Biden laptop, and I was just in Delaware looking for that laptop and trying to give it to the Biden campaign and the Chris Coons campaign, so maybe they would do something about it. The same fake news media are now, of course, trying to perpetrate yet another fake news election and a coup. It amounts to a coup here. And there's a long track record of many foreign folks interfering here and in influencing this election. China, okay? Also, Zuckerberg and all of the money that he brings, along with Soros. There are many, many tens and hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm sure it'll be billions by the time we investigate it all, that prove that there's massive foreign collusion going on, which is why you heard about foreign collusion with Russia, which was essentially not.
So are you before I go on to the next guest, just to make sure, so are you basically approving what Trump is saying? Not approving, but
that will bear out. That will bear over time. That will, it will bear out that this is a fraudulent election. It will bear out that this is a coup attempt perpetrated by largely foreign influence agents from, you know, many different countries.
Richard Becker, you heard our guest there. Okay, thank you for that. Let me get a reaction from our guest, Richard Becker. So you heard our guest there, and we can see how dangerous this is. Obviously, if we have our guest being representative of many Americans who obviously, I'm guessing, have the same viewpoint, and how the U.S. president is towing that line. How dangerous a precedent is this setting for what may be coming?
Well, I think it's a ridiculous storyline, and your other guest has the Trump storyline down pat, word for word. I mean, there's so many things about it that are actually quite humorous. Like, for instance, China is interfering in our election. Well, Biden and Trump have actually, I'm not a Biden supporter, I'm not a Democrat. Biden and Trump have virtually the same kind of line, negligible differences over a hostile policy toward China. So if China's interfering in the election, who are they trying to get elected? Gloria Lariva, the socialist candidate? I don't think so. I mean, these are just, you just pile one of these ridiculous stories on top of another ridiculous story. The bottom line is this, is that Trump is such an egomaniac that, you know, anything that goes against him has to be fraud, or it has to be foreign interference or something like this. I mean, it's just really ludicrous. Trump wants the vote stopped, because he's demanding that the vote be stopped now, because he knows in all likelihood that the corner has been turned and the vote is probably going to go against him. The popular vote is going to go massively against him. I think it'll come to way in excess of what it was in 2016. It'll probably be in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 million more popular votes for Biden, despite the fact that, you know, and again, I'm not a Biden supporter, and I witnessed, along with many other people, the Democratic National Committee crushing the Bernie Sanders campaign in order to give the nomination to Biden. 99% of the people who you asked, even Biden supporters, asked them a question, what does Biden stand for? Their answer can only be, we don't know, but he's not Trump.
That's the DNC and the CCP have fully melted.
That's the only attraction that Biden has really had, is because a very large part of the population, Trump has his supporters, but a very large part of the population is repulsed by his misogynistic, anti-women, anti-LGBTQ, against immigrants. You know, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah, only one candidate didn't need like hundreds of millions of dollars of big tech money to dump a bunch of buckets of phony ballots, though.
Those politics have repulsed a great number of people. The gap would be even wider if it wasn't for the corrupt process of the Electoral College, which was built into the U.S. Constitution at the very beginning in order to separate the power from the people. And so it continues to be... that continues to be a highly undemocratic, that institution.
Go ahead, Bill first.
We're melding here fully, rhetorically, and in fact, word and deed, into a full-on democratic people's republic right before our eyes. If you go look, there's a lot of good reporting coming out in places, swing states like North Carolina, Pennsylvania, where there's clear evidence of Chinese interference through the Confucius Institutes.
Oh, that's
even Ray,
you know, really
Dr.
Gonna say
Ray
that? That's
is
just
not
ridiculous.
Even a fan of.
What are they interfering for?
He's on record.
Who are they trying to get elected? Biden's even more hostile to China than Trump is. So why would they be doing that?
You're saying who is more hospitable to China than Trump?
China is. He's saying
Biden is more hostile to China and the people around him.
Is that a joke?
He's literally taking money from China. Who are they trying to get elected?
He's on the dole, bro.
It's ridiculous. It's just more of these fantastic conspiracy theories, conspiracy stories that go around in this election.
So who's the big guy? Who's the big guy in the emails on the Hunter Biden laptop?
It doesn't make them true or accurate.
Who's the big guy on the Hunter Biden laptop? Who's the big guy?
The big guy?
The big guy, yeah, for the 10% for the big guy on the Hunter Biden laptop. Who's the big guy? Were they talking about Hunter's anatomy, or were they talking about the guy in charge of the whole money laundering scheme? Which was it? Surely you're aware of the Hunter Biden laptop.
So let's move on.
No.
I get where you're going with that, Noel Fritch. Let's move on to one of the things that our guest, Richard Becker, talks about. And there's a couple points that needs to be made here, and really interesting to get your thoughts on this, and that is the whole electoral process. We're looking at how that is breaking down, not breaking down in numbers, but breaking down in its efficiency or lack of it. Many have criticized the U.S. system because of this electoral process, electoral vote, which is not really, some say, representative of a true democracy in the way that the popular vote should be the
one. We don't have a democracy. We do not have a direct democracy and a popular vote democracy. The Electoral College is the entire point. The whole point of the Constitution of the United States of America is to grind the gears up and slow some of this stuff so that you don't have, like when you see a state like California or Oregon just fall off the cliff, which is getting ready to happen, and already just in the last year in Virginia is happening. So you don't have that single party, like this. Mr. Becker, of course, would love to have a single party state rule, just like in China, where the CCP runs everything. He would love to have the Democrat Party just run everything. And he spoke very uncritically about the Democrat Party simply just choosing Joe Biden to the mild protestations of all of the Bernie people. And that is exactly what they are on about. That's exactly what the idea of denigrating the Electoral College is all about. And they're doing it with many, many hundreds of millions and billions of dollars from foreign influencers like Soros and Zuckerberg. Okay, and all of these dollars, these people are not elite, don't have any allegiance to the United States, just like you guys. You guys don't like to have in Iran. You guys have a great country with a long history of, engineering, art, the academy. You don't like to have foreign governments interfering in your election, which is exactly what we have here. Just like Biden Obama and his team went to interfere in the Israeli election. It was kind of interesting. They wanted to get rid of Netanyahu on behalf of the communist guy, Benny Gantz, right? So we have a long track record of watching this happen, playing across country and national borders, and they're welcoming it here in the United States, the Democrat Party is.
Okay, let's expand a little bit about where this is going, given the state of affairs right now. Currently, Richard Becker, and even if a vote is, or a result is actually announced, obviously we're looking at polarity that pre-existed before the elections, and perhaps now that's being expanded because of what Trump is saying. Many of his statements many see as being very controversial, and of course once the announcement is made, what do you see happening once this announcement is made in terms of the impact it's going to have on the American people?
Well, that is the big question. It's been clear for some time. Trump has made it clear that he's not inclined to accept the outcome of the election. He's refused to say that he would. So you have that. And if the election were to be stolen, and I think that the Trump is trying to make a power grab now and trying to push his federal court appointees to do his bidding in regard to shutting down the electoral process, because he can see, as everyone can see now, that in a number of key states that add up to 270 electoral votes or more, he's slipping backward. So it's very possible that there is going to be ongoing struggle, and it may be ongoing struggle in the streets as well as in the courtrooms that follow when some of the states, and a number of the states won't actually certify their elections for a month, but some of them will give unofficial results. And I think that it's very likely now that by Thursday or Friday, tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, that it'll be clear who has won the election. And I think the likelihood at this point is that it will be Biden, and then we'll see where it goes from there.
Noel Fritsch, what would happen if Trump lost this election?
Well, first of all, I do think it's going to be a little while. Just as the media was predicting that it was going to be weeks and months, I do think you're going to see a lot of investigations into folks like the Center for Tech and Civic Life up in Chicago, which is an Obama-tied organization, Zucker-tied, Knight Foundation-tied, Soros-tied organization, which has pumped many tens and hundreds of millions of dollars into specifically these swing counties and cities in a couple of key states. So yeah, all that's going to be investigated. I'm pretty confident that the Trump administration is not going to take this lying down. It is basically mandatory that the United States maintain free and fair elections, free from foreign interference from the likes of China or Zuckerberg or people like Becker or people like Soros. We cannot have foreign interference in our elections from all these people. And nor should we be interfering in Israel's, right? That shouldn't happen. Look, we don't want to have a one-party state.
Yeah, should stop sending billions of dollars to one year to Israel. I agree with that. That's what you mean. Stop interfering.
Quickly sliding.
Stop interfering against
sliding to a one-party state.
One-party people, for instance.
State.
For instance, there.
Okay, you're both talking over each other. I'm sorry. Richard Becker, hold on a second. Noel Fritsch, go ahead. Richard Becker, I'll get to you in a second. Noel Fritsch, go ahead.
To put a bow on it there, the United States is quickly sliding to a one-party rule state. Like you see in California, where it's an S-hole. You see in Oregon, where it's a S-show. Virginia is turning into an S-show. Just go look at San Francisco. There's poop all over the street, and there's all kinds of degenerate actors, I guess they're citizens, behaving in all kinds of crazy ways, like you see in Tel Aviv. It's just unconscionable. That is not the United States of America. We do not want to see that here.
Well, just on a side note here, Richard Becker, if I may ask you, was America like this years ago? Are we seeing what we're seeing today, something that was simmering beneath the current, and now it's come out to the fore with the election of President Trump, perhaps bringing all these feelings out? Because we're seeing, again, it sounds like a broken record, but we truly are seeing a divided America. I mean, we're looking still at Trump to have brought in quite a number of votes. It wasn't maybe perhaps what many people did think. But then again, again, that's just one perspective of it. But more the America today, how it was brought to this point.
Well, first of all, let me say that comical characterization of what life is like in San Francisco by your other guest is really very, very amusing. I mean, I live in San Francisco. I lived here for almost 40 years. It's not what it's like. That's more of the Trumpista mythology that just goes on and on and on, making up these stories of Trump saving children from sexual slavery when they're coming from Central America. I mean, the most ridiculous things get said now. There is a great polarization that's going on in U.S. society. There's no question about that. And I think the polarization is essentially an outcome of the built-in contradictions which have been very aggravated of the capitalist system itself. The climate change crisis, which is a very, very deep crisis and is driven by the profit maximization of profit
above
all. And the deprivation of people in adequate education, adequate health care, adequate housing, while the billionaires and super billionaires, and I'm no friend of Zuckerberg or Soros or any of them, they get richer and richer and richer. Even in this crisis, in the COVID-19 crisis, as the crisis has proceeded, they have aggregated to themselves.
This is the culmination of that crisis. This is why we had the crisis. Everybody knows it.
Billions of dollars in added wealth, while the poor get poorer in the society. The contradictions are in many different. There are contradictions in.
They're buying this election right now, sir.
Areas.
They're buying this election right now. Are you going to call out their money?
The dark money. As long as capitalism continues to exist.
Noel Frisch, 30 seconds to you. Go ahead. 30 seconds. 30 seconds. Yeah, go ahead, Noel Frisch.
Mr. Becker going to call out all of their dark money, their hundreds of millions of dollars that they're throwing into all of these cities? Is he going to call that out? They're literally buying the election. He's talking about doing away with capitalism. That's an open communist statement. Look, and the reason that we had COVID, all Americans know it now. In their gut, they know it. Not that it's not a real bug. It's a real bug. But the reason that it was unleashed on us from China is to steal this election. And everybody knows that now.
It's a disease, and it's spread all over the world.
Okay. I guess we're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guests for participating in this debate, Noel Frisch, conservative consultant and commentator from Washington, D.C. I'd also like to thank Richard Becker. Thank you very much from the Answer Coalition, who spoke to us from San Francisco.